ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello and welcome to ID, the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, and today I'm speaking with Jonathan Wells, a senior fellow at Discovery Institute who holds two PhDs, a PhD in theology from Yale and a PhD in molecular and cell biology from UC Berkeley. He's the author of multiple well-known books, including Icons of Evolution, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Darwinism and Intelligent Design, The Myth of Junk DNA, The Design of Life, and Zombie Science. So thank you so much, Jonathan, for coming on the show with us today.
It's a pleasure, Casey.
So we're here today to discuss Dr. Wells' contributions to a new book that's being released in October of 2021, titled The Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith, Exploring Ultimate Questions About Life in the Cosmos. The book is being published by Harvest House, and I'm a co-editor along with William Dembski and Joseph Holden, and we certainly hope that you will check it out as the book is available on Amazon.com. It has contributions from many leading ID thinkers, such as not just Dr. Wells, but also others like Michael Behe, Stephen Meyer, Douglas Axe, Guillermo Gonzalez, Walter Bradley, Robert Marks, Michael Egnor, Brian Miller, myself, and many others, and it addresses numerous important topics related to science and faith. So Dr. Wells, you have two chapters in the book, one titled, What Are the Top Scientific Problems with Evolution? And another titled, Is Darwinism a Theory in Crisis? They're both really nice summaries of the issue, which I've enjoyed editing, and I appreciated your contributions in these chapters to the ID literature. And I want to say that I felt like your first chapter, What Are the Top Scientific Problems with Evolution, kind of took me back to your 2000 book, Icons of Evolution, because that book makes such a big impact on me. And if you don't mind me saying, when that book came out in the year 2000, I had just finished my undergraduate degree, basically 4 years of taking many courses in evolution. And I think I read that book in early 2001, just as I was starting my master's degree in earth sciences at UC San Diego. And I know that folks despise that book in the Darwin lobby. You're more acutely aware of this than anyone, Jonathan. But when that book came out, it really put so many pieces of the puzzle together for me. Because again, I just finished taking 4 years of many courses in evolution, and the book was so current, and it dealt with so many relevant topics that I've been learning about in my science courses over the previous 4 years. And it did so in a manner that cited the technical literature. And so as a budding young scientist, I could go back and look up your references and check them out. And I always found that they did check out. They always said exactly what you said that they were saying, and they supported your arguments. And it gave me so much confidence that evolutionary theory really was a paradigm in crisis. So I just want to thank you for your work in this area, Jonathan, which has helped me so much in my own thinking, and I'm sure it's helped so many other people as well. So thank you for the great work you've done over the years explaining the problems with evolutionary theory.
Well, you're very welcome, Casey. Thank you for your kind words about my work.
Well, I really mean that. I just finished giving a talk on the problems with universal common ancestry, and I can even say that so much of the work that you did in the year 2000 is still relevant today. It influenced my own thinking, and I literally every day, I just the ways that I think, I don't even appreciate how much they've been influenced by your work. So I really mean what I said.
Well, thank you.
Okay, well, let's get into your first chapter on the top problems with Darwinian evolution. In that chapter, you list various definitions of evolution. And I'd like to ask you, what are some of those definitions and which ones are the most controversial ways of defining evolution?
Well, evolution, as you say, can mean many things. It can mean simply change over time. I've never met anybody who disagrees with change over time. I imagine there might be a few, but I don't know them or of them. Evolution can also mean history of the cosmos, history of technology, and we all know that these things have a history. So evolution in that sense is uncontroversial. Evolution in biology can refer to minor changes within existing species, which all of us can see, even in our own families. It can also mean the, I think, undeniable fact that some things are living today that weren't always with us. And there are some things that lived in the past that are no longer with us. So evolution in that sense is true. The problem comes when Darwinism insists that all of this was unguided. So for Darwin, he called his theory descent with modification. First, all species are descended from one or a few common ancestors. And second, they have been modified by unguided processes such as natural selection and accidental mutation. It's the unguided part that is controversial and should be, because I don't think it's supported by the evidence.
Well, I would certainly agree with you, Jonathan. And it's very interesting to me that you can define a term which in some ways can be so uncontroversial and in other ways is so controversial. So let's talk about another idea that is somewhat controversial in biology. It's the concept of homology. What is homology? And are there features in biology that have strained or defied explanation via classical evolutionary definitions of homology?
Well, homology is one of the pieces of evidence used by pro-Darwin people to argue for common descent. Homology is the similarity in structure and position of certain features of the body, like the bones in our hand are similar in structure and position to the bones in a dolphin's flipper or a bat's wing or a bird's wing. And so classically, even before Darwin, these similarities were called homology. Darwin argued that they are evidence for common ancestry. And he said they don't make any sense on the idea of separate creation, only if they're inherited from a common ancestor that had these features.
So are there some features in life that are difficult to explain via this typical explanation of homology?
Yes, many, as it turns out. The human eye, for example, is a camera eye with a lens and a retina. The octopus eye is also a camera eye with a lens and a retina. And yet nobody claims that the human eye and the octopus eye come from an ancestor that had such an eye. The list of features is very long. Paleontologist Simon Conway Morris wrote a book showing that homology, or rather non-homology, is what he called it, ubiquitous. Now, these features are called convergent. That is, they are similar. They look like homologies, but they do not come from a common ancestor, such as the eye of the human and the eye of the octopus. And there's a long list of such features. Echidnas in South America are small animals with spines that look very much like porcupines with spines. And yet the two could not have had a common ancestry because their reproductive systems are so radically different. The same is true of flying phalangers in Australia and flying squirrels in North America. Their features, the flaps that enable them to glide, would be called homologs in any situation except the one we have, which is that their reproductive systems are so different, they had to come from different ancestors. And the list goes on. So convergence is more common than homology. Because things that look alike may not be due to a common ancestor, Darwin's followers redefined homology to mean similarity due to a common ancestor. The problem with that is, well, there's lots of problems with it, but one is that if homology is similarity due to a common ancestor, it cannot be used as evidence for Darwinian evolution, because that would be arguing in a circle. How do we know that features A and B are descended from a common ancestor? Because they're homologous. How do we know they're homologous? Because they're descended from a common ancestor. So that gets us nowhere.
So there's a circularity in the definition of homology there. That certainly poses a problem for arguments for common ancestry, I think.
Yes, it does. It's a circular argument is inherently true. It's true no matter what, but it doesn't get you anywhere. All it gets you is a circle. So the evidence that Darwin thought was some of the best he had for common ancestry turns out not to be.
So what about fossils? They've been a longstanding challenge to evolution. How do fossils pose a challenge to Darwin's theory?
Well, the fossil record, even Darwin acknowledged that the fossil record is a problem for his theory. Because as he put it, if his theory were true, then there would be innumerable transitional forms in the fossil record, because the changes between species are very small and very gradual. These innumerable transitional forms have never been found, despite intensive fossil collecting over the century and a half since Darwin wrote his book. In fact, one of the major features of the fossil record is called the Cambrian explosion, in which most of the major groups of animals appeared at about the same time, fully formed. We can distinguish an echinoderm from a vertebrate, even or a chordate, even back then. These differences, according to the fossil record, did not emerge gradually, but suddenly. And there are many smaller examples of that in the fossil record. So the record is not a good piece of evidence for Darwin's theory.
You also talk about molecular phylogenies. What is a molecular phylogeny, and do they pose a challenge to Darwin's central idea of descent with modification?
Because homology and fossils did not solve the problem of how are we going to prove common ancestry, modern biologists have increasingly turned to what's called molecular phylogeny. Now, a particular molecule might be present in a wide variety of organisms, but yet be slightly different from one organism to the next. It could be a protein, an RNA, a DNA, and biologists can compare the molecules in, say, species A, species B, and species C. And if the same molecule in species A and B, they're more similar to each other than species A is to species C, then the biologists might infer that species A is more closely related to B than it is to C. And doing this over and over with many molecules and many species, biologists have put together what they called phylogenetic trees. Now, Darwin's theory, of course, is that life is like a tree with one trunk and many branches. The problem is that molecular phylogenies have not matched up to the fossil record. In fact, they don't even match up to each other. The more molecules we examine, the more inconsistencies we find. So instead of converging on a one true tree of life, molecular phylogenies are pretty much all over the place these days.
Yeah, that was always an issue that struck me, Jonathan, when I was a student and then reading your work over the years, how I was taught that there were these nice, neat phylogenetic trees that explained how organisms were related. But when you dig into the data and the technical literature, you find that it's a big mess. What about natural selection? That's obviously a core part of Darwin's theory. Do we have good evidence that natural selection can produce new complex features?
Well, Darwin thought that the main agent of modification during evolution was natural selection, or survival of the fittest. He himself had no evidence for it, and he admitted as much. So the first evidence that apparently emerged was over a century later, and that consisted of evidence from peppered moths. Peppered moths come in several varieties, mainly a light one and a dark one. And around 1800, almost all peppered moths in England, we know, were the lighter color. Then the Industrial Revolution came along, and polluted air started turning the tree trunks darker, and the proportion of dark moths increased dramatically. And so this was considered to be evidence of natural selection. Well, I won't go into the details, but there are lots of problems with this story, one of which is that the peppered moths don't normally rest on tree trunks in the daytime. But better evidence actually came along in the 1970s from the Galapagos Islands, where biologists closely observed a particular species of finch on the islands. And when a serious drought killed much of the vegetation on the island that was being studied, about 85% of the finches died. And of the 15% that remained, the average beak size was about 5% larger, which supposedly enabled these birds to crack the harder seeds. So the biologists inferred that given a couple of hundred years, this could actually produce a new species of finch. The problem is, after the drought ended and the rains returned, the smaller beaked birds flourished and the average size went back to normal. So there was no net evolution. So the bottom line is, we know that natural selection occurs, but it has never been observed to produce anything other than minor changes within existing species.
Okay, let's talk about producing changes in species. Mutations have also been an important part of Darwin's theory, but do mutations produce the kinds of beneficial variants that Darwin's theory requires, or what do mutations tend to do?
Well, a mutation in modern understanding is usually a change in the sequence of DNA, an accidental change, usually. Darwin did not know about them. He admitted he did not know the origin of new variations. But in the 1950s, thanks in part to the work of Watson and Crick, mutations became identified with these changes in DNA I just mentioned. And then they were combined with Darwin's theory to provide an origin for variations. And Darwin's theory was thought to be complete. In fact, it's now known in many circles as neo-Darwinism. The problem is these mutations are overwhelmingly harmful or else neutral. That is, they don't produce any effect on the organism that natural selection can work on. The rare ones that are beneficial, and they're very rare, produce only minor changes in molecules. They do not produce the new species, organs, or body plans needed by Darwin's theory of evolution. For example, biologists have now mutated the embryos of fruit flies, fish, mice, worms, in almost every conceivable way to generate as many mutations as they could find. And they did find a lot, but the outcome is always the same. We can mutate a fruit fly embryo as much as we want, and there are only three possible results based on the evidence: a normal fruit fly, a defective fruit fly, or a dead fruit fly, not even a house fly. So the contribution of mutations to evolution remains very problematic.
Okay, so my last question for you is about how new species emerge. How do we define species? And is there good evidence for speciation that natural selection, random mutation, these mechanisms of Darwin's theory can produce new species?
Well, as you indicate, the very definition of species is a problem. A definition that fits reproducing species like ours may not fit bacteria, which don't reproduce sexually. It may not fit fossils, which don't reproduce at all. So when I wrote about this 2006, that there are currently several dozen definitions of species being used by evolutionary biologists. The most common in use among evolutionary biologists was called the biological species concept, which is that a species is a reproducing population that is separated reproductively from other such populations. And experimentally, scientists have tried to induce the formation of a new species by separating them reproductively. At most, this has produced what are called incipient species, by which Darwin meant varieties that were on the way to becoming species. The problem is, we don't know if they were or are. Incipient species is a prediction. It's not evidence. Until we actually see it happen, it's not evidence. So the evidence for speciation by selection and variation is pretty much non-existent, other than secondarily inferred from what we already see, but it has not been directly observed.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wells, for discussing these top problems with evolution. I think this is very helpful for our listeners to get a summary of your arguments. Of course, they can dig in for a lot more information if they check out the book, The Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith. It's available on Amazon, and it's a wonderful treatment of the issue of evolution, intelligent design, and many other science faith issues in an in-depth yet concise manner. So I highly recommend listeners go check out this book, The Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith, on Amazon. Dr. Wells, thank you so much for your time with us today and for talking to us about the problems with evolution.
It's been a pleasure, Casey.
I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.